Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com.
Well, welcome back to another sterling episode of the Azure Podcast, episode number 69, being recorded on the 18th of March, 2015. I am Sujit Mello, and on Skype with me, I have Kale Teeter and Evan Basilik. Guys, it's just the three of us today. We did have somebody lined up to talk to us, but she had a dental emergency to take care of, so we'll get her some other time.
I completely understand. Some things take precedence over.
Yeah, especially when it's related to your teeth.
Yeah, exactly.
But we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, and we haven't had one of our internal roundtable discussion, so this might be a good time to do it.
Yes.
Okay, so the first one that I was very, very this one might seem a little off topic from the Azure space, but actually this is related to Azure, and this is the Rowhammer bug, which, I'll be honest, I had not heard about this until recently. Have you guys caught on this issue with the Rowhammer?
I saw the internal stuff on it, but I'm not enough of a hardware guy to. I mean, I guess this makes sense when you read it, but it had never come to mind for me.
Yeah, Kale, this might be something you might be interested in as well. Some guy, I think he wrote a thesis project or something on this. This relates to memory, just random RAM bits. And what they've done is, because RAM has become so condensed now, you know, as they've increased the capacity, like it used to be like 1 gigabyte chips were great, then it was, you know, 8 gigabyte chips, and now you get 16 gigabyte chips. So they keep, shrinking it down. And what that means is that the adjacent bits, the ones and zero cells, get closer and closer physically in these chips. And what he found out is that in some machines, he just used, you know, some random laptops from the market, you know, nothing special. And if you take the same block of memory and do repeated writes on it for a period of time, what you can do is you can make the bits leak to adjacent bits, I should say. So, you know, just because you're changing the value so rapidly, you're kind of changing the voltage or whatever it is on those bits so frequently that it starts to have an effect on the bit next to it, you know, or in the next bank, in the next page. And this way you can actually make changes to memory that's outside of your process space. So if you were, you know, as a general user process space, you were allowed to write to this block of memory. By carefully crafting your code, you could induce a bit change outside of your block of memory. And we all know that if that happens, you can, you know, a couple of things might happen. Your computer might crash, which is probably what happens most of the time. Or you might be able to do something with that change. In other words, gain access to the computer that you weren't able to access before, you know, because you're accessing memory that's out of your space. And if you can do it in a way that, you know, it makes sense to the operating system might simply allow you to gain, excuse me, some sort of access, like a root access or something like that. And there were some guys that did some tests in this, and they were able to get on a Linux Linux laptop, they were able to get access, which was outside of their permission set. So it was an interesting thing with this with the Rowhammer bug, and so that, I guess, there's been internally there's been some discussion about, would it impact our IaaS VMs, right? And that's the first question people want to ask. After all, we do have, you know, all the RAM that's running in our VMs as well as our or SSDs and whatnot, and you have to question that. So I think the we kind of use ECC RAM, error correcting RAM. Is that what it stands for, ECC?
Yeah, I'm not actually sure what the second C stands for.
Error.
I thought it was like error correcting and change or something like that. There's two.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Yeah. So we use ECC RAM, and ECC RAM has that extra bit that essentially will validate that the 8 bits that are being updated are, you know, make sense. In other words, if one of them is not what it should be because of a leak from an adjacent bank, then it would catch it right there because it would notice that that bit was not set correctly, the ECC bit. And typically when that happens, it simply halts the system and it, you know, it creates a dump of some sort. So, turns out that I don't think our systems are susceptible to this Rohammer issue, but it was a really interesting, read. You know, you never think that, I hope that there haven't been any attacks or any exploits made by, some nefarious people out there that take advantage of this, but you just never know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that kind of I thought was interesting when I was going through this is, you know, a lot of times you're reasonably protected from this stuff because if you're using, say, you know, SharePoint or something, right, or Office 365, you're really not deciding what code to execute.
Correct.
Right? So your ability to attack with something like this is, I mean, almost non-existent. I mean, I guess there is, I guess, theoretically always the possibility. But in Azure, right, we're running whatever code the customer wants to on their VM,
right?
So it even if it's a really small chance, it's much, much higher than you would see in a, you know, in like an O365 environment.
Right. In a SaaS solution versus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder how much you mentioned, and not picking on Linux, but you mentioned they tested this on Linux. I wonder if that's able to defeat the that DEP stuff that we have built into Windows, the data execution prevention.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know there's a lot of that kind of error checking for the memory to make sure that things don't leak across inside a process.
Yeah.
I'm wondering
if
that would actually catch that too. I didn't see anything listed about that, but...
I think it's probably another catch against that, right? I mean, I don't know enough about DEP to know other than it used to break some things that I would see, you know, people do inadvertently. But, you know, I think it's all about defense in depth, right? We're using ECC at the hardware level. We're using DEP at the software level. You combine all the different things and you really reduce that attack surface, right?
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. And, it goes to show that, you know, we're getting so complex with our technology now. It's the little things that could get us into trouble. And
I mean,
things
literally, like in this case, right? Literally.
Exactly. Literally the little things, yeah. I mean, who would have thought? So, yeah, so we'll put a link in the show notes, those blog items somewhere that we found. Then what else? There was Convergence 2015. This is like some sort of a CIO summit or leader summit. Is that what it is?
It's our the Microsoft Business Solutions conference.
Okay. Okay.
You know, so CRM and the other
Dynamics.
Things. Yeah, Dynamics and all that kind of. Yeah.
Okay.
That whole business suite.
And it's mostly like it seems like it's mostly industry leaders or. I guess from different lines of businesses and industries get together, discuss common problems or solutions that they have, and maybe involving, I guess Microsoft is obviously recommending Dynamics and their CRM suite. But
yeah, I've worked the help desk there a couple of years, a few years back, and it's really a neat conference because it's not as I mean, it's all Microsoft focused, but it's not as techy as some of the conferences I've been to before because, you know, the audience for that software is much more business focused.
Correct.
Right. And so it's kind of a different flavor of attendees than most of the other conferences I've been. Like Build is like super hardcore techy, right?
Right.
And this is, you know, again, there's a group of them like that, but it's much more they're trying to figure out how to run their business with this stuff versus, you know, what's the neat, cool way to code something or whatever.
Right. The interesting thing that came out of that was this year, they had it in Atlanta, was this IoT toolkit, the Azure IoT suite. And that's what caught my eye. I think we briefly discussed this a while ago, where we were starting to build this Azure Intelligent System service. Mm-hmm. I think we covered it briefly in one of our podcasts, and that was meant to take away some of the pain with collecting all this large amount of information that's coming to you from various sensors and things like that you may be trying to monitor. So there's various parts involved with the whole process, and the Azure Intelligence System Service was meant to, I think it takes up, it makes some of the whole process a lot easier, but it was not a complete suite because if you think about it, there's a lot of moving parts, right, to both capturing, processing, as well as reporting on all this information. And it looked to me that this Azure IoT suite now is an all-encompassing service that Microsoft's going to offer, which does everything from soup to nuts in the IoT space. Just takes away all the complexity that anybody would have, because let's face it, IoT, it sounds cool, but it's extremely complex. I mean, no matter how you do it, there's just too many moving parts in any IoT solution. And it looks like they're putting together this suite, which will have everything in it that anyone might need, including ready-to-run applications for common scenarios, like vehicle monitoring or manufacturing, things like that.
So this kind of supersedes the that intelligent system service? Is that what this is? It's like an iteration of it? Or
exactly. That's exactly how I read it, too. It's... the intelligence system was sort of like a starting point to this whole journey, and the IoT suite is the evolution of it, and it's complete maturation of that whole idea of essentially making it like plug and play to use IoT within your environment.
And this would be like that you mentioned a couple of different things there, Saji, like just gathering the data as well as, processing the data and then providing some sort of useful output from it. Mm-hmm. So this would be, this suite is kind of, I don't know, I'm just trying to think about it the way we think about things we did in the past, like analysis services with SQL Server. So that was like a suite of things inside of SQL Server. Is that kind of how this works, right? You can just pick the pieces you want, like if you already have some way to process it, but you just need something to gather massive amounts of data, you could just leverage that part, right?
It's a good point whether you could pick individual pieces. We do have our individual pieces still there, right? For example, Azure Stream Analytics is a common one. That's still available as a standalone system. So if you do need just that one component, you can just use Azure Stream Analytics as it is today. That's available now. So we have our individual services. It's just, it does take a lot of work to tie them all together as well. And I think that's what this tries to do. It tries to tie together all those individual services into a complete end-to-end offering for a company that needs a complete end-to-end offering. And typically, if you're starting from the ground up on this, you're going to need it, right? But if you already have, if you're a Chevron or an Exxon and you have a lot of assets already, there's maybe just small pieces that you're looking for, in which case you can then use the individual pieces that are already available.
Yeah, I think
go ahead, Evan.
I was just going to say, I think that's kind of what I took away from what I didn't see the full announcement, but just kind of what I've been reading about is, it's providing the whole thing, but I kind of got the same impression you did that you don't have to use it all at once. It's services, right? You can plug and play the pieces that you need to make it work.
Right.
Yeah, the thing I think that kind of hit home to me a little bit, it was close to home, was there's also some offering now, right, from MCS, so the consulting services that Sujit and I work with. It's like a free half a day or something like that?
Right.
Is that what's
going on? Yeah, the Quick Start program. Yep.
Yeah. So it basically help you to identify what pieces you would use from this IoT suite and kind of scope a POC type thing.
Yep.
That's cool.
That's a good point. We should put that in the show notes as well in case people wanted it. And that's free. So this way, you know right away whether you know, this is a huge undertaking, it's going to cost you millions and billions of dollars, or it's something more reasonable to your budget without spending too much money to get started.
Yeah, and I don't, I was talking, one of the guys that sits near me at the office is kind of helping to kind of design the support side of this overall IoT experience. So I cornered him today and made him promise that post-build, where we got a bunch of announcements around this stuff, right? We got new stuff coming in the near future. Once all that stuff is out there in public, he promised to come on and talk about some of the things that are going on there. So just a little bit of a, hopefully a precursor for our audience in a couple of months.
Would love that. That'd be great. And as, which brings us to the next thing. Builds is coming up. Well, where are we? Today and tomorrow, first of all, we have the .NET conference, which is the virtual conference, which is pretty nice, actually. I caught a few of them, a few of the sessions today. It's all future stuff, you know, Visual Studio 2015, .NET 2015. It's kind of confusing, but the way they're versioning .NET now, but they're going by the years instead of version numbers. And there's a couple of Azure tracks in there as well about migrating to Azure. But then after that, we have Ignite, and then we have Build. Is Ignite over already?
No, not quite.
It's in May.
That's in May, right?
Yeah.
And then Build is after that, is it?
After that.
Okay. Oh, is it after? I thought it was actually before. But I was wrong. I thought it was actually in April, but maybe I could be wrong.
Yeah, I know. All I know is I got a whole bunch of features and things that I'm trying to get ready to support, and they're all either launching at Ignite or they're at Build.
Oh, it looks like it's right before. So it's April 29th to the 1st is Build, okay. And I know
Ignite
that
right
Ignite.
After that.
Yeah, Ignite's right after that. The 3rd, I think it starts.
Now, what's the difference between what is Ignite? Is that more the
What's the audience? For
is that the UI audience? Or?
I'll actually just a plug here. I'll actually be presenting there at Ignite. But
oh, cool! Look at that. And this wasn't planned, guys. By the way, just so you know.
Yeah. Now I think Ignite's new, right? So this is the first time I think.
This is the one we combined a couple other conferences into this. Where is it this year?
It's in Chicago.
Okay.
But it's going to be everything, you know. I think Build is, you know, my take on it. It seems like Build is a little bit more like Evan was saying earlier. It's kind of like the hardcore development, that kind of thing. This is more of like everything else, you know. So it has some development stuff, but it also has a lot of infrastructure, you know, a lot of Azure stuff, obviously, and then also some Windows stuff as well.
Oh, so this is the Tech Ed.
Replacement? Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah.
Okay, I get it now. Okay, cool. And I guess are you allowed to say what you're going to be talking about?
Yeah, I was going to say, what are you going to talk about?
Oh no, it's nothing earth shattering. So we had our exams, right? So the Azure exams now, they're kind of hot out there. People are taking, and I'll be doing one of the prep sessions for the development exam 532.
Great. And a teaser, I guess, for an upcoming show. We're going to be talking to one of the guys on this, right? One of the guys who designed the exam, who had a say in it. We're going to have him on the podcast coming up in a couple of weeks. That's a hot thing.
Yeah. So, Sajid, have you, I know we've got some of the internal requirements now that we all, depending on role, right, you have a different one you got to take. Yeah. Have you taken yours yet?
The 534, I have to take the architecture exam. Nope, I did a practice test. I still have a little brushing up to do in some areas. it's interesting, you know, they all these scenarios that you have to go through and whatnot. It's a different way of, I haven't done, a test in 25 years, so it was a little bit of a...
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't, so this just goes to show you how long it's been since I've taken a certification. The last certification I had was VB6.
Wow.
Wow.
I was an MCSD on VB6. That was probably, probably 15 years ago, maybe, something like that. So it's still good. It technically never expired, so I just kind of coasted on that for a long time.
So there's three now, right, for Azure. There's a bunch of other, obviously there's tons of exams out there, but there's three, right? There's an architecture, dev, and then infrastructure, essentially. But I took the last gen, so I think it was 2012, we released some tests for Azure, but I think there was only two then.
Yeah, they were both more focused on developing, right?
Yeah, so they were pretty much, that was right after Azure had come out and from 2010. So I had taken those, and then I took these, and I could say that these are much more detailed, much more covering. The other ones were definitely real high level from a platform, but I guess our platform has really gotten more advanced since then.
Yeah, it's just the breadth, you know, that's what, there's so much you have to cover.
I, as a kind of an experiment, I walked in cold to 533, so the infrastructure one, and, you know, I've been doing Azure for forever, right, before it was Azure. And I passed, but I didn't, you know, it wasn't easy, right? I mean, I didn't pass with flying colors, but I passed. And, you know, it was, so there's, I agree with you. I agree with you, Kale. I mean, there's, it's pretty broad. And it is a big platform.
Yep. And I'm doing the architecture one, which really covers everything under the sun.
Yeah.
We'll get there. Okay. I wanted to, you know, we've had this issue at our customer, and I just wanted to discuss it with you guys. You know, a lot of customers want to go to the cloud, right? But they're not ready to actually go to the public cloud. So there's always been this concept of the private cloud. And what that means is that they want to have the best of what a cloud offering does have, like, you know, self-service, the whole PaaS, the IaaS setup. But they want to have that internally. And we have Azure Pack, as you all know. We talked a while ago with some of the guys on that.
Yeah, a couple weeks back.
Yeah. And that covers IaaS very well, right? And I think it also covers websites, is that right?
Yeah.
IaaS and websites. But there is no PaaS offering in Azure Pack. And we actually, you know, unfortunately, the customer that I'm at, we lost out to another company that did have a PaaS cloud offering internally. So they're, you know, based on OpenStack, I suppose, which is the other popular PaaS system out there. And I always wondered why have we not integrated PaaS into the Azure Pack? Is it just the complexity of it, of offering a PaaS service? Or, like, I mean, the way I see it, to offer PaaS, you'd have to offer, obviously, the compute and the storage pieces, right? And it should be done in a way that's, you know, self-serviced, I guess, redundant and all that stuff. Is that just too complex to do for an internal system?
My take on it, or kind of outside looking in, is, as I understand it, Azure Pack underneath is really System Center plus Hyper-V.
Okay.
Right? And that System Center isn't really PaaS aware. Right. Versus you can do IaaS just with a, you know, I mean, if you think about a really good System Center environment can kind of act like IaaS anyway.
Right.
So by, you know, kind of wrapping it in the Azure Pack, we get kind of that uniform interaction while still leveraging that underneath. But I suspect that's probably more the bigger driver, is you just don't really have a way to implement PaaS.
The base system doesn't support it.
Yeah.
Okay. You know,
yeah, I guess the thing I was thinking about was the fabric controllers and the things like that that we have inside Azure that kind of help manage all that stuff. I think they, I don't know, I guess that would be hard to emulate that kind of functionality maybe in the future, I don't know. But.
Right, I was thinking the complexity of it, to do it right? I mean, yes, you could just do it and kind of hack it together, but if you really want that, you know, fault domain, you know, update domain, all that stuff, right? Because that's all hard to do, I would imagine. It's not easy.
Yeah.
That's the secret sauce, you know.
That is a secret sauce, exactly. And maybe just too difficult to put that together for an internal system. Well,
yeah, not sure.
It's just something that, you know, I hope we address in the future. I think it's a missing, it's a hole in our offering right now. All right, and just a general question, and if we do, there's another, we're going to go into another segment after this, but before we get there, this question came up internally on some of our DLs about, are the Azure VMs limited in terms of the number of TCP IP connections they can accept in any way? Is there, Evan, are you aware of any such limit?
No, so there's obviously IPv4.
Just the OS limits, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's more than just an OS limit, right? Because it's also a, it's an IPv4 concept, right? If you can only have 64,000 some odd
the sockets, ports, the socket
or sockets. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now I know there are some quirks to it where, like the SLB, we allocate pools of SNAT connections or SNAT pools, excuse me. So pools of connections, and if you spin up a bunch of connections really fast, mm-hmm. We don't always keep up, right? Because we create buckets of them, and sometimes we don't create a bucket fast enough. You know, if you're just growing really, really fast in terms of your use, and so that manifests as it's like you run out, but you really haven't. If you retry, it'll just, you know, continue going. But yeah, beyond that, I've not ever seen or heard anything. I mean, obviously, your perf may not be so good if you have a lot of connections.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any limit outside of those.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I've seen some pretty high connection counts on some VMs in the past, to the point where we did run into the socket limit for a couple of people. Wow. Which, yeah, that was kind of impressive. I'd never thought anybody would do it, and they did it a couple of times.
What size VMs were they using, do you recall? Not the small ones, right?
Yeah. No, they were running, I think they were running pretty decent size. This was back in the PaaS days.
Okay.
And this was one of these companies, what they had is a bunch of front ends, mm-hmm. you know, so a bunch of PaaS servers talking to a bunch of SQL database servers, and any one front end could talk to any database server. So by the time, you know, they might have had, I don't remember the exact numbers, they had a couple of hundred servers, and they had a couple of hundred front ends, and when you did all the crossing and possible combinations, it was kind of weird. We had to we had to put a cap on the number of connections allowed in any given ADO.NET connection pool,
mm-hmm.
because otherwise you would, you know, let's say you had a spike in number of connections to a given database. Well, now there's 10 connections in that pool. Well, if you have 200 databases, you know, all doing 10 connections in the pool,
right?
You know, you're at 20,000 connections right there.
Right.
You know, and so what we had to do is we did the math and said, okay, no one connection pool can go above 2, right, or whatever the number was to do that. Because, but just again, by the time you cross all the potential combinations, it was they mathematically couldn't make it work if they let it be an unbounded number. But yeah, that was kind of a really fringe scenario.
That's very unique setup there.
Yeah.
Okay, so Evan, you had a good idea of a little roundtable discussion we can have between the three of us. Two questions that we'll each try to answer. What's our favorite Azure feature, and which is the one thing about Azure that drives you crazy? Okay. good questions, I must say. So who, Kale, do you want to go first?
Sure. So my favorite feature, I don't know if it's a feature. I guess it's just the way that it works, and we just mentioned it a minute ago, is how our Fabric controller works. I mean, if you start reading some of the details about how that infrastructure actually works behind the scenes for the update domains, the upgrade domains and the fault domains, and how that whole system works. And there's a lot of that that's been publicly exposed. You know, Mark Rusinovich has given a lot of that stuff out at like TechEd and such. And if you start reading about that, it's fascinating how that thing actually works. So from a geek perspective, I think that's probably the coolest thing. I don't know if it's necessarily a feature that people see. I mean, it's kind of like back end stuff, but I kind of think that's one of the coolest pieces about Azure. And for the thing that drives me crazy, this is something that I hope gets enhanced in the future. But right now, especially here in New York, being in this region, we have a lot of finance and biotech companies and those kind of things. And, of course, security is, like, huge on their mind. And networks. So being able to isolate networks, segments, provide filtering and logging like they have in the past, which I mean packet level, low level, logging on everything that's happening and being able to isolate subnets and all the routing, you know, doing custom routing and those kind of things. I'm hoping to see that stuff get enhanced in the future because it drives me a little crazy. We have ways to kind of work around it now, right? We have, you know, network security groups and we have virtual appliances and all these different things that we can use to control the traffic flow inside Azure. But Hoping for some more knobs and dials there in the future, because sometimes that gets a little hard to build solutions for, you know.
So I'll make you a deal on that, Kale. I'll push for that. If you push for somehow trying to figure out when it doesn't work, which is the part of all those knobs that is broken. it is just purely coincidence that you bring that up, but I was working a Kritsit last week and beginning of this week where the customer had firewall rules plus force tunneling plus network security groups on both the source and the destination. And just trying to like trace where the packet was blocked and which rule would apply to which subnet, it just absolutely made my head hurt. That kind of made me wish for the days of everything's wide open in all the different directions.
that's a good point though. When it comes to tracking down these kind of networking issues, is something like Wireshark at all useful in our internal environment? Like, can we run it?
You mean at the host level, at the guest level?
In a VM, for example, you have a bunch of VMs and they're connected in these funky ways.
Oh yeah, all the time. We do that on a regular basis. I mean, they're just fundamentally VMs, and so there's nothing kind of blocked off.
Yeah, but there are switch networks, right? Like, how does it work in terms of picking up promiscuous traffic and things?
Yeah,
like that?
You're not going to get the promiscuous stuff, but you'll get you're limited to just what your VM would see.
Okay.
So you're just limited to your traffic. Now, the interesting part is when I get to participate in some of the things where we actually do host level traces to try and see, okay, is it blocked at the host or is it blocked at the guest? You know, things like that. And in that scenario, I can see promiscuous stuff, but yeah, we don't share those with customers generally, but yeah, we can certainly do it.
Right. Okay. That's good. Good to know that. So, Evan, you have a favorite feature?
Yeah. So, you know, and I guess this is kind of my server background coming in. I just the G series VMs are probably my favorite. Right. I like, you know, I get to, you know, I talk to the outside world a good bit, right, between this and I do some conferences and stuff. And I've kind of started doing this thing where it's like, okay, whose server is bigger than mine, right, my biggest one. And I'll spin up a G-Series, the biggest G-Series while I'm doing it. And so far, nobody's beat me, right? 448 gigs of RAM and 64 cores. I mean, you know.
Or do you run some software to measure a performance or something as a comparison? How do you, just based on pure size?
No, just based on pure
numbers,
resource. Yeah. I don't know if you guys have ever done it, but it's, by the way, it's $10 an hour to run at the biggest G5. I did the math not too long ago. And it's really neat to pop it open and pop open Task Manager and then switch it so it shows all the CPUs. I mean, it's like this, you know, console of 6 8x8 grid of CPUs. It's really kind of impressive when you look at it.
That's neat.
Yeah, that's kind of my favorite thing. My least favorite feature is, and this is probably nitpicky because it's really specific to my world, but the hybrid connectivity portal that shows you whether or not your connection is up or down has been broken for ExpressRoute since the day we launched. And it's still broken a year later. We're on like the third bug that is preventing it from working. And I'm just, it just drives me crazy. I email the dev who owns that piece like every week, like, okay, did you fix it yet? Did you fix it yet? So.
And what is it? Is just not too many people hitting it? What's not bumping
well,
up the importance?
Well, most people don't look at it is really what it comes down to. So it hasn't been, you know, and once you know it's working, you just kind of know it's working. You don't ever go back to that page. Right.
So Evan, which one are you talking about? Is that the page like where you see your gateway and see those like colors where it's connected?
Yeah,
it looks like two segments are connected.
Yeah, it works fine for site to site and works fine for point to site. But when you go to ExpressRoute, it doesn't work.
Ah, I didn't even know that. Huh.
Yeah, you would have to set up the ExpressRoute connection to see it. And I'm not kidding you. I had a customer have a Seve case because they were going off the portal that it wasn't working. It was like, oh no, that's just a bug. One of my least favorite bugs, but drives me bonkers. I'll probably actually after we get out of this, I may have to email the dev tonight just see if I can nudge him again.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. So how about you, Sajid?
Oh well, so I do, you know, a lot of dev work, and for me, I love the table storage. That's why I talked about PaaS earlier too. I really miss PaaS internally if you could offer it to our customers, because things like the table storage and the blob storage and queues, of course. I mean, in a way, we've always had blobs and queues in some form or another in Windows. We never had a table storage, and it's so, you know, just the raw speed of that table storage. You know, assuming you do it correctly with the partitions and rows, the fact that you can just put any amount of data in it, you know, it seems to handle any amount of size, and you have total control about it, right? If there's a problem with it, it's because you didn't do something right. It's very rare that there is, you know, an inherent slowness in the storage subsystem in table storage itself. So I've been using that a lot. I've been using it in different ways for very high speed transactions, and you know, it seems to work very well. So I'll be continuing to use that. This is not the feature that drives me crazy, but the one thing asked that I would hope is covered in terms of table storage is, I think I may have mentioned it before, is that it provides this is some kind of tool that can provide you with some kind of a hint as to, oh, you know, this is doing like a table scan, you know, like how in SQL, yeah, you know, you have, yep, those, yep, query plans kind of thing. It'd be nice to find out, like, you know, how bad is this query? You know, is it, am I shooting myself in the foot by doing it this way, by asking for the results in this way or querying it this way? So that would be nice to have, if at all possible.
Do you find yourself, places where you would have thrown in like just a baby database, just with, you know, one table or something, that you're now just doing table storage for those kind of things?
That's exactly right. Yeah. I have maybe 20 or 30 of these tables that I'm using regularly. And normally I'd have like single database with like, you know, little baby tables in it, you know?
Yeah.
Say, I don't use SQL as much because I'm using the table storage for all of those things.
It's funny, I had never thought about that, because I'm actually working on something at work right now where some of the scripts that we use to kind of automate some of our analyses, we want to do an instant feedback loop. So we basically pop up a dialogue in the end and say, you know, did this help you? And do you have any, you know, did this break? You know, things like that. And I'm putting that in what is basically a baby SQL table. I really ought to put that in table storage.
If it doesn't have too many indexes, then I think, you know, you're fine putting it in table storage.
Yeah, I may have to go back and refactor that now that I'm thinking about it. So, that's a really good point, Sajid.
Like, I was building this one system where you could vote on an item, right? You know how you have the like and dislike in Facebook. So you can imagine that's something that would, you'd be getting a lot of updates, and that could grow. That kind of information could grow fairly rapidly too. So I did it by, you know, using the table storage, and I keyed off, you know, the row and partition table had the keys that I needed.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen any performance. I have, you know, blasted that thing, and that's doing updates, right? It's actually looking for records and constantly increasing the count or decreasing the count. That's what the like and dislike would do.
Mm-hmm.
It never seems to break a sweat, you know.
How do you are there ADO.NET providers that can sit on top of that, so if you're using an ADO.NET paradigm for, you know, data readers and whatnot, that you can dump that on top of table storage?
No, not that I've seen. I use Link, if at all, or there's the native.NET API, the storage API,
okay,
that has some constructs in it, you know,
okay,
like a table query construct, a filter construct, things like that.
Interesting. Yeah, I may have to play around with that.
And then in terms of the thing that's driving me crazy, and I'm sure this is something that you guys also face, you know, ever since we started the podcast, we had a couple of services in Azure, you know, PaaS, IaaS, things were simple, it was easy to follow, and now there's like, seems like, you know, every week there's the number of services keeps on increasing. And not only is the breadth of services difficult to keep a tab on over time, it's, you know, what services to use in what scenarios is getting a little more confusing. I have a feeling we have a lot of overlapping services, like services that do the same things in different ways. And we have to offer some sort of clarity to our customers, to our listeners, on, you know, for which, like, why do we have these multiple services? For what, like, why would you use this service and not that service?
Yeah.
So I don't know if you guys also, you know, see it that way.
I miss the days when there was only, you know, a dozen services instead of, you know, five dozen services or whatever we've got now. So, yeah. No,
yeah,
it
I've
does make it tougher
internally
to figure out what to use.
Yeah, I've heard people internally refer to it saying, you know, it used to be you could say you knew Azure.
Yeah.
And it would be hard to say that now. Okay. Because to say that you are an expert in every area would be... It's too big. I mean, it moves too fast, and it's too much now, you know.
And it gets to the point if someone does present you with a hypothetical scenario, like one of those tests, for example, a good one.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, there's like six ways to do this now. Which, you know, which way am I going to do it? So I hope that we can do something in terms of. I think it's a documentation issue, some guidance, those kind of things. We have the architecture blueprints, which are good, but they have to be updated more frequently.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the general problem, right? I mean, across the board is, you know, if you go, you know, if you're using some Windows feature, right, there's 20 years of content out there that says when to use it, when not to, you know, what it's good at, what it's bad at, you know, and this stuff, even if it's been around, if it's been around for 6 months, it's considered, you know, old.
Right.
And trying to keep the content up to date and, you know, referencing all the different versions is, or different variations is tough. I mean, really tough. And I can't imagine how it is for, you know, people like you guys in consulting where you guys go out and people want to know what's the best way to do it. And, you know, you present something and say, well, yeah, but what about this thing that came out this morning that you didn't include in your, you know, in your conversation?
Oh, yeah. And they always seem to want to, you know, we're supposed to have the answer on the tip of our fingers, no matter what the question is. So it's, it is difficult.
Yeah, it always becomes, for me, like, it always becomes an interview. You know, it's always like, well, we want to do this thing, and so we want to use Azure Storage Tables for this. Okay, so what are we trying to do? It always comes back to that, like, okay, let's take a step back. What are we trying to do here? You know, and it's that interview of pulling out what exactly they're looking for from DR to HA and speed, like performance and all these different things, and then trying to formulate that in your head and say, which service fits this, you know?
Yeah. Stuff. No, exactly. Agreed.
Great. That was a very nice roundtable. Good idea, Evan.
Thanks.
All right. So any other closing thoughts? We've discussed quite a bit for an episode where we didn't have to start off with much to talk about.
Yeah. No, this was always fun. Be interesting to what do we have on the tap for next week? Do you guys remember?
I think it's maybe that is it the guy?
Is it the exam? Certification? Or
the certification,
the,
yeah.
Yeah, certification.
It's the certification guy, yeah. You know, I was talking to my, taking my son for trumpet earlier today and driving back and telling him we're going to do the podcast. He's like, oh, you know, you guys should do one of those geek out podcasts, you know, where you talk about something totally not related to Azure. I was like, that's a good idea. We need to do that one time. Come up with a geek out idea, you know, which is some common theme that three of us have that is not Azure related.
Yeah, well, we'll do that when we run out of Azure services, right? I'm sure it'll be
that'll be in
or something.
2019, yeah, around that time.
Sure. Sounds good, guys.
All right.
Nice.
Have a good night.
Okay,
right,
see
thanks.
You.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.